Gospel of John. We've had a couple of lessons now on Sunday evenings. Going to start, though, by going back over a number of verses that we had not seen yet, and then using them as springboard into a discussion from chapter 7. But first, just like to have you see the enormous amount of controversy that there is in John's Gospel. What I mean by this, if you turn over to the very first chapter, and we're only 43 verses deep into this Gospel of 21 chapters, but at verse 43, it says that the next day he purported to go for, or purposed to go forth into Galilee. That's not the verse I want. Where did I miss it? What have I done wrong here? I know it's in the first chapter, and I had a controversy where somebody was arguing with Jesus, and now I don't see it. What did I do here? Now see how much fun I have even when I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have time to hunt for it, so I don't know what I did there, but turn over to chapter 2, and you can find it when you get home. There is one of those. Now, oh, I think I know what it was I was looking for. Is down in, here it's coming up. Give me just a second. It was 46 that I was looking for. Actually, 46. I'm sorry, I just got it wrong. But in chapter 1, verse 46, where Nathaniel says, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" I think about the first time that you have this idea of, let's go tell somebody about Jesus. What's the response that the carrier, the bearer of that message, you know, gets in reply? Why, you're asking me to believe the impossible. You know, this is a rhetorical question. There's no good thing can come out of Nazareth. You must be out of your mind. Okay, so as the gospel gets underway, as early as it possibly can, before Jesus is really even, you know, publicly making much of an appearance, people are thinking, can't be so. Now come to chapter 2 and look at verses 13 and 14. Oh, these will be the right verses. The Passover, the Jews was at hand. Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves and money changers seated. And then I'm not going to read the rest of this because you know the story from there. What immediately happens? Jesus is involved in controversy. And it's not just controversy where, you know, we maybe need to have another session to talk this out and make sure we understand each other. You know, it's not that at all. It is driving people out of the temple with a whip. Jesus is facing off with his entire society and the power brokers in that society, the people with the most power and influence in that society, from the get-go, from the very beginning of his preaching. Look what happens over here in chapter 5. There were some more minor ones that decided I wasn't going to put on the list here in between. But come on over to chapter 5, a chapter that we studied in its totality 2 weeks back. And remember there then at verse 18, "For this cause, therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he not only was breaking the Sabbath, but also was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God." Well, by this point, which is early in Jesus' preaching, we're only in the fifth, you know, chapter of the Gospel, they're ready to murder the man. And they want to kill him because of a doctrinal disagreement that they have. And of course, they're utterly in the wrong, and Jesus is entirely in the right, but nonetheless, that doctrinal disagreement, and every doctrinal disagreement, brethren, whether it's among us in the church or with those that are outside, doctrinal disagreements are intense. They get the, you know, the dander up to the extent here that they're willing to kill him. But it's not just that. It's also that they think he's arrogant. They think he's conceited. He's making himself equal with God. You know, I think maybe the one thing that we might say or do that would evoke the same response from people today is when you suggest that there's only one church that's pleasing to God. And then immediately, what does everybody think you are? Why, you're just arrogant, you're conceited, and you're some kind of terribly, you know, condescending, and you're out of your mind in the first place, and everybody knows there's no such thing as only one church that would be pleasing to God. And we're going to get a similar kind of a response. They read it as some sort of superiority complex, and you think you're better than everybody else. Brethren, we're none of those things, and Jesus wasn't either. But if you're going to have conviction, even if you're wrong in our part, though Jesus could never be, you're going to have conviction and stand up for something, even if you have to change your mind later when you realize you were mistaken, you know, people are not going to like it. They're going to accuse you of all sorts of terrible crimes and attitudes. Chapter 6, which we looked at last week, is most interesting. Made all these points last week. But in verse 15 of the 6th chapter, Jesus therefore, perceiving that they were intending to come and take him by force to make him king, withdrew again to the mountain by himself alone. That's a conflict. And by force? By force? Those people must have realized or had some kind of an inkling that he would be hesitant to accept their overture here. So they're thinking, you know, well, we're going to try and make him king, and we're going to have to cover our bases. He may not want to be one. And maybe, you know, they've got a good reason to believe. They figured out he's not likely to want to do such a thing. So that there's a conflict. Even when they want to make him king, they're prepared to do battle with Jesus himself. Jesus' day is not going very well there already. Then you get to verse 26. Jesus answered them and said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled." Well, now he's rebuking them for having the wrong motives for attending his assemblies. Skip on down to verse 41. You don't have to go much farther. The Jews are grumbling about him because he said, "I am the bread that came down out of heaven." In verse 52, the Jews therefore began to argue with one another, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" In chapter 6 and verse 60, many therefore of his disciples, when they heard this, said, "This is a difficult statement. Who can listen to it?" And you note that their attitude is revealed in the first half of the next verse. Jesus, conscious that his disciples were what? They're grumbling. They don't like what they're hearing. They don't understand it maybe, but they still don't like it. And so they're grumbling, they're arguing with themselves, each other that is. They're arguing with him that this is not going well at all. In verse 66, as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. Now, brethren, you know, if by the end of my first year here, many of you have withdrawn from the congregation, I expect a few. I really do. You know, congregation, everybody's going to like the new preacher. I know that. But if I'm looking out here, you know, and a third of you have left, would that be many? That'd be many. You know, if a third of you have decided to abandon this whole effort and you're pointing your fingers at me, what might I just start to tend to think? Maybe it's not a good idea. Of course, I'd be tempted to blame it all on you. You know, it's all your fault. But the reality is, it much more likely, in my case, be whose fault? It more likely be my fault. That's what it would be. You know, certainly that thought's going to cross my mind. It's not crossing Jesus' mind, though, is it? No, he knows that even if you're losing lots of people, that might be the best thing that can happen. And so, in verse 67, Jesus turns to the 12, the core of everything, and he says, "You don't want to go away also, do you?" It is a challenge for them to follow that third or 50% or however big the number was and say, you know, bye-bye, because he knows what he's doing is the truth. But by the time you get 6 chapters deep in this gospel, you're pretty impressed that Jesus is really swimming upstream, isn't he? He's facing a heavy headwind. He's just got hard times everywhere he goes. And of course, about this time, maybe you're thinking, Jesus warned us that the disciple is not above his master, and if they did this to him, I believe he, you know, introduced the next thought with, how much more, you know, and so we're not nearly as talented or capable as he is. We are worthy of being criticized for our own failures. I've made lots of mistakes in the last 10 months, and I'm planning to make many more. And, you know, you come to expect that human beings are this way. But brethren, most human beings, by the end of chapter 6, are pretty well done, too. They're cooked. I can't take any more of this. Aren't we glad that Jesus, and really all the earlier, many of the early disciples as well, weren't weak like that? And they really had some backbone, and they were really able to say, you know, this is bad, we wish these things weren't happening, it's terrible that there's controversy and all this going on, and disagreement and arguing, people leaving you and all of that. Is any of that ever an excuse for anybody to quit serving the Lord? No! Brethren, if 95% of this congregation got up and quit, tomorrow the only people left is me and the elders. Should we then say, let's abandon the faith, we obviously have proved ourselves wrong? You know, no. That's not to say we're hard-headed. It's not to say we're arrogant. None of those things. It would mean, probably, we'd all of us be really reevaluating how we do what we do. But to abandon the Lord, no excuse. Your service, your commitment, your faithfulness, your attachment to God and to His Son and to His people is not contingent on how all those people behave. It's just a fact that we are to serve our God in whatever circumstances that we find ourselves. But as we're going to discover tonight, it's after all of that that then he gets hit with chapter 7. It's not like things get any better here. So, see what happens right off the bat, chapter 7 and verse 1. After these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. And so, when this chapter starts off, he realizes, I'm going to have to abandon the entire area of Judea. I'm going to have to travel up and beyond Samaria, clear to Galilee up there, you know, and I better stay up here for a while so I can stay out of the reach of the long arm of the law. I'm going to get killed if I go down there. That's all a part of God's plan. Jesus understands this. I'm sure he's not surprised by it. But we are being told. God wants us to know that this is to be expected and that it may change all your living circumstances. You have to learn to adapt to these things. So, at the get-go of chapter 7, the Jews want to kill us. Now we come to verses 2 through 5. The feast of the Jews, the feast of the booths, was at hand. His brothers therefore said to him, depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may behold your works, which you are doing. For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For not even his brothers were believing in him. And now you learn from verse 5 the attitude and probably the expression, the way that they express themselves when they uttered all of those words. They were mocking Jesus. They were making fun of their brother. They were trying to point out that he was a hypocrite. They were trying to say that you're not doing right. If you really want to make a splash and be an important kind of a person, well, you don't seem to be doing it right. But all of that was because they didn't believe in him. It wasn't with a good heart. It wasn't because they were trying to help him. It wasn't because they had any respect for him at all. They were putting him down. His own brothers in the flesh, who, by the way, had all of their childhood to recognize that Jesus has never committed a sin in his entire existence. They're in a better position to appreciate the superiority of the character, of the intellect, of the knowledge of this individual. They don't believe in him either. So I'm beginning to think, brethren, maybe we ought to appreciate that this gospel is spending extra time. It's more, I believe, than you're going to find in the other gospels, at least in the early going, of the resistance that Jesus had to face. And of, therefore, the courage, that stoic stick-to-itiveness that he had to have in his character. I am going to do what I believe is right until somebody convinces me it's wrong. And because they don't accept it is not evidence. That's because people reject it, even if they hate me, if they kill me, if they drive me out of my home. That does not mean that I'm wrong. I need evidence. Then I'll change my mind. But until then, conviction is when you are that immovable object that the philosophers are always bringing into contact, you know, with that unstoppable force, you know, as they play their games. But brother, that's just the way Jesus was and is our example in that regard. The family doesn't believe what you believe. Well, we're sorry about that, but it's not changing my mind. Nor the religious leaders of the day, or anybody else around me up to and including, in Jesus' case, the 12 themselves. But now, look at verses 6 through 9. Because in 6 through 9, brethren, I think what you have
is an answer to these first five verses. You've got, I know, verbally Jesus is answering, but you know, it is an answer. Two, it's something to remember and know when you're faced with these kinds of oppositions yourself. So in verses 6 through 9, Jesus therefore said to them, "My time is not yet at hand, but your time is always opportune." And that's with specific reference to what they had just said. If you want to do these things, you know, you ought to go up to Jerusalem. He said, "Well, it's not time for me to go up to Jerusalem." We know he will go to Jerusalem, but it's not time. You guys can go any time. I have to go at a particular time. So in 7, "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its deeds are evil." Now, brothers, as a matter of fact, you go back and you look at all these verses, we just read every single one of them. You know, they are not all of them fitting into the category of what I at least think of as saying to somebody, "Your deeds are evil." Now, it sure was when he was braiding that whip. He started turning over those tables and spilling money, you know, all over the courtyards of the temple. Well, that's pretty well getting the job done. You know, you've made this place a den of thieves, robbers. That's an accusation. But not in a lot of what he has said. They just didn't understand his doctrine. They just didn't understand things. What do you mean, give us your flesh to eat? And so they're opposed to it. But Jesus is saying, look, you got to expect this. I expect this. I understand this. It is an element or an aspect of this teaching that he gives us here in these verses. They hate me because, and I'm going to expand on this a little bit, Scripture teaches everywhere, brethren, they hate him because his very existence is a criticism of the way they live their lives. They hate him because even if he didn't say their deeds were evil, the way he conducts his affairs is living proof and example that their deeds are evil. He doesn't hate them like they do. They did the opposite of what he does. He must think the way these people behave is evil. And it is. So when he says, you follow me because you want the bread. You haven't come because you saw the signs. It's because you want the meal. He never said, your deeds are evil. He didn't do that. He just said, here's your motive. Everybody gets the point. The motive is evil. It's incorrect. Brethren, for Christians, we really need to get this, that folks will not like you, and it won't be a thing in the world you can do about it, and it won't be because you've done anything wrong. And you won't need to go home and just tear your hair out trying to figure out, how can I be more effective Christian? What can I change? How can I have said this? What can I have done over here? There isn't anything you can do. They're not opposed to the way you did it. They're opposed to the fact that your life, if it is properly conducted, is a life that is in a straight and narrow path. And they'll see that. They'll know that. You don't have to say anything for them to get the message. So Jesus is expecting this hatred. He's explaining it to these, the very brothers. So what happens in the next few verses? Well, in verse 10, when his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he himself also went up, not publicly, but as it were in secret. Jews, therefore, seeking him at the feast, were saying, where is he? And there was much grumbling among the multitudes concerning him. Some were saying, he's a good man. Others were saying, no, on the contrary, leads the multitude astray. Yet no one was speaking openly of him for fear of the Jews. But when it was now in the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and he began to teach. You just can't win, can you? You just can't win. So here some are grumbling and they're saying, he's a good man. Others that he's leading people astray. And over everything, they're afraid of Pharisees who want to kill him. So we don't get accused of being one of his disciples. Maybe they want to kill us. What a great start to Jesus' work. He sure proved himself to be the ultimate salesman, didn't he? So far, how's this great plan of bringing the gospel working out? Well, it was going great up to the point where just by the tens of thousands, they were going to make him king. And then what did he do? Put the kibosh on that, didn't he? And next thing you know, you've just got everybody's confused, everybody's unhappy, everybody's grumbling, and from wanting to kill him to just walk away and never have anything to do with him again, just does not look like Jesus was just the most capable presenter of ideas that we ever saw. But what do you know about that? He's perfect. He's exactly perfect. He tore the whole society up. He destabilized everybody. They can't, any of them, figure out, you know, what to do with this man. And that's not a problem. That's exactly perfect. Just the way it ought to be. You can't fault Jesus the way he does things. And now he explains in verses 15 through 24. Long passage, let's just read it all. The Jews, therefore, were marveling, saying, how does this man become learned, having never been educated? Jesus, therefore, answered them and said, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If any man is willing to do his will, he shall know of the teaching, whether it is of God or whether I speak from myself. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory. But he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there's no unrighteousness in him. Did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you carries out the law? Now, brethren, there's an accusation of evil. Why do you seek to kill me? There's a revelation of supernatural knowledge. And now they're going to lie about it. The multitude answered, you have a demon. Who seeks to kill you? Jesus answered and said to them, I did one deed, and you all marvel. What deed was that? Now, get your pencil out. You need to make a note. That deed was 18 months ago. And it's the healing of that lame man in John 5. It's been 18 months since that guy. Okay? But that's the last time Jesus has been healing anybody. Says, I did one deed. Now we got all this going on. That's something to think about right there. So, make a reference. In this gospel, you got to go back to John 5 for that one deed that it did, in fact, upset everybody. Now he says in 22, on this account, Moses has given you circumcision, not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath, you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. I've heard there's a lot of criticism in there. There's some wonderful doctrine in there. I'm just working on the overview right here. So what I'm pulling out of this is initial statement there. His explanation, what John, the inspired writer, is led to record for us on the heels of his telling us all Jerusalem is upset, is that Jesus is answering these people by saying, look, I am not in this for myself. I guess Chapter 6 pretty well proved that when they would have forced him to become king and he wouldn't do it. You know, I am in this for God's glory. So, Jesus is teaching, appreciate this, believe this and understand this. If you think I'm arrogant, that's not the case. If you think I'm intractable, you know, I'm just the kind of guy you can't be persuaded, I've just got a hard heart. No, I'm unyielding because God's will is at stake here. I have no choice. He's just simply saying, everything I'm doing, I am doing for him, not for me. It is for God's glory. If they had any objection to that, brethren, they should bring their evidence. But you all know how well it would go. Jesus was doing everything for God's glory. But as a result, when he was trying to give God the glory for everything, when he never in an instant ever sought any personal payback in this earth because of it, what did he get from this earth? Nigh universal hatred, rejection, arguments, grumbling, the loss of disciples. When you seek, brethren, God's glory in a world where the large number walk the broad path that many are on and leads to destruction, they're not going to like it. And they're not going to like you. Seeking God's glory
is going to make for fewer friends and acquaintances. That's not over. Now we got 25 through 27, where it says, therefore, some of the people of Jerusalem were saying, is this not the man whom they are seeking to kill? And look, he's speaking publicly. And they're saying nothing to him. The rulers do not really know that this is the Christ, do they? However, we know where this man is from, but whenever the Christ may come, no one knows where he's from. So what has Jesus still got?
After all he's done in the preceding chapter, and faith and answer, after all he's been working with right here, what have I got in verses 25 through 27? But more confusion. So again we are told, they don't get it. They're still not getting it. I'm getting along about this time. You know, I'm thinking it's time to take up, you know, horseshoeing or something. This is just not working. Not for Jesus. He has an answer for all of this. Verse 28 and 29. He cried out in the temple, teaching and saying, you both know me and know where I am from. And I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. I know him, because I am from him, and he sent me. And brother, you know, if I'm right earlier, and the idea that there's only one church is just going to get universal, you know, rejection, what did Jesus just do right here? Very similar thing. I'm from God. There's only one that is from God. So he's not backing down at all, and we must not either. Brethren, we too are sent from God. We too are a part of that plan. That church that would have no end to the increase in his kingdom and government, that's us. It is our job to bring about that increase, to meet as many as we can, seek as many as we can, ask as many as we can, encourage and teach as many as we can, to be just like Jesus as much as we can. And if we do what he did, then we'll be what he was and we'll get what he got, won't we? So he just says, God sent me. Brethren, he's sending us too. Don't get discouraged. The more effective you are at living a life that is like Christ and of presenting the gospel the way he did, the more guess what you're going to get in return. More opposition, more resistance, more passionate dislike. It's not going to get better. It's more likely to get worse if Jesus is any example. See what happens in verses 28 through 32. You both know me and know where I'm from, and I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true. I guess I just read that, didn't I? Okay. Oh, I read 28 and 29. Okay, so let's go to 30. They were seeking, therefore, to seize him, and no man laid his hand on him because his hour, mentioned that earlier to his brothers, didn't he, had not yet come. But many of the multitude believed in him, and they were saying, when the Christ shall come, he will not perform more signs than those which this man has, will he? The Pharisees heard the multitude muttering these things about him, and the chief priests and the Pharisees sent officers to do what? Same thing they attempted to do in verse 30. You get the word before and after in this passage, in 28 and in 32. Twice. They send out guys, they try to capture him, they try to seize him, and they can't do it. Run for your life if you can, brethren. Jesus will teach this too. You know, they persecute you in this city, then what? Flee to the next. The brethren, they will never persecute us in this city. Until what? Until we're like Christ. Until we incorporate so much of his life into our lives that they see him in us like a city on a hill, like a light with no basket over it. Until they see it in us. Until they hear it in us. Until we teach and preach like he did. We're not going to get kicked out of this city, brethren, which perhaps ought to be our ultimate goal, until we are so living the life that Jesus lived and preaching the gospel that he preached that we get universal rejection. Well, twice he tried to seize him. Here comes another answer to this. Verses 33 through 39.
Jesus therefore said, remember, Jesus therefore said, for a little while longer I'm with you. Then I go to him who sent me. You shall seek me and shall not find me. And where I am, you cannot come. The Jews therefore said to one another, note how often they won't talk to him. They go to, you know, each other. People still do that today. They don't get to the principal party, you know, instead of just chatting, you know, among themselves. But in 35, the Jews therefore said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we shall not find him? He's not intending to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, is he? You know, it's funny, but, backdoor kind of a way, and not realizing it at all. They're kind of getting it, aren't they? Where was the gospel ultimately to go? To all the dispersion and the Greeks. You know, so yeah. And the one time they get an inkling that's actually correct, you know, they think that's impossible. So in 36, what is the statement that he said, you will seek me and will not find me, and where I am you cannot come? Now, on the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, saying, if any man is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the Scripture said, from his innermost being shall flow rivers of living water. But this he spoke of the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive, for the Spirit was not yet given, because Jesus was not yet glorified. So there's a lot to come. We understand the gospel, you know, will not see its fulfillment in the church until that day of Pentecost. We're a long ways from that. But after all of this, look what he says. He says, I'm still here. I'm still offering the same thing I always have. If you will come to me and drink, there'll be living waters, just rivers of it, just gushing up inside of you. Is Jesus softening the way he teaches? Is he backing down in any way? Or does he continue to make statements that are so true and comforting to you and me today, but must have been just incomprehensible to them? And I know they were. We get an explanation. He was speaking of the Spirit. You know, you wouldn't see that without that information. Finally, we come to the end of the chapter. Some of the multitude, therefore, when they heard these words, were saying, this certainly is the prophet. Others were saying, this is the Christ. Still others were saying, surely, the Christ is not going to come from Galilee, is he? Has not the Scripture said that the Christ comes from the offspring of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was? So there arose, which would be pretty well expected by now, I guess, wouldn't it? Division in the multitude because of him. Some of them wanted to seize him, but no one laid hands on him. The officers, therefore, came to the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said to them, why did you not bring him? The officers answered, never did a man speak the way this man speaks. Now, brethren, that's about the poorest excuse for dereliction of duty I ever heard. Next time some soldier goes AWOL, you know, fails to accomplish his mission, he comes back and says, well, the guy you sent me to arrest was such a great speaker. How do you suppose the officials are going to respond to that one? The Pharisees therefore answered them, you've not also been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this multitude which does not know the law is accursed. It just won't make them mad. More division, more argument, more unhappiness. Nicodemus, though, brethren, verse 50, look at that. He said to them, he who came to him before being one of them, our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he's doing, does it? They answered and said to him, you're not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee. What do you got at the end? Same thing we had at the beginning. All of Jerusalem is upset and arguing with themselves and arguing with Jesus and argue. So surely, neither this man, his disciples, or anything he teaches can be true. Right? Brethren, if ever there were two chapters now to teach us what it is
to stand up, plant your feet, wait for the tsunami, and when it passes, just be standing there like Colossus of Rhodes. It's these two chapters. Cody Kelly, go to Austin and stand like a rock out there. Whatever happens. And for everybody here that's sitting behind a cobra, brethren, that's what these chapters are about. Now it's just, yeah, so much doctrine, didn't get into really any of it. I understand, Jesus taught a lot. But throughout all of it, when you see this laid out like this, can you appreciate how God says, stand firm on the rock. Be a rock. Let nobody beat you down. Let nobody be so negative and so much of a failure or whatever else goes on around you that it would impact your faith. Just be there as solid as the earth itself with your faith. Expect it. Create it. Survive it. And continue to preach it. That is how you came to be a part of the Church of Christ today. Because, brethren, these people did their job in their time. And it was done after that time, and it's been done in every time. That church has never vanished from the surface of the earth. It's just now that it's our time to be like Jesus and like the disciples after him. Absolutely unyielding in the face of all the opposition that ever confronts us. Jesus is Lord, isn't he? Say yes. He is Lord. And nothing will deter us from preaching that, because it's the truth. I appreciate your attention. Thank you so much for this whole day. Really, my heart is just soaring here after all these meetings that we had. Thank you so much for being a part of it. Brethren, now the week confronts us. To the work, to the work. If you're not a Christian, become one tonight. Let us help you learn what you need to know so that you can respond to it. Let's be baptized into Christ tonight, free from all those sins, united with him in baptism and in death, to rise to walk in newness of life today. If you need help, personal Bible studies, some prayer requests, let it be known, please, as we stand and sing.